no dejaremos que cierren la linda puerta que siempre ha estado abierta a la vida.
You're listening to Latin Radical with Warwick Fry.
Jim Dunn is kept informed with some of the latest information coming out of East Timor, and perhaps you could tell us a little bit of some of the later developments in the Renato killing, Jim.
Yeah, generally, I think from a security point of view, the latest developments have been fairly positive. Perhaps the most important is that the petitioners, who numbered about 600 and had loosely formed part of the military under Reynado, he considered himself their commander. Well, over 400 of themselves have come into a cantonment in Dili, which was arranged by the government virtually to begin the process of surrendering and I think accepting conditions which had been offered them, probably an offer that had caused Reynado some anxiety because it seemed to weaken his authority. Anyway, this is a very significant development because it certainly reduces the number of rebel followers out there in the interior. Another recent development, only in the past 24 hours or so, is that a number of Salsina's men have surrendered with a couple of heavy weapons. So the scene now is fairly positive, but I think what is more important is it does seem, particularly in a way sparked by the funeral of Alfredo Reynado, where his adopted uncle, whom I knew, he was there, came there in my day, has appealed to the people at the funeral to end the violence and to stop this. And the other accounts I'm getting is there's a general feeling in the community, enough is enough. They'd never had that before. They'd never had anyone trying to assassinate a leader. That hadn't been part of the political scene in East Timor. Mm. The only killing of a leader, of course, was carried out by Indonesian troops, and that was, of course, Nicolau Labatu. So, really, it's a sad development, in a way, because I didn't think that Reynado was an evil man, misguided, with an exaggerated feeling of his own importance. But nevertheless, although he led rebels, armed rebels, they didn't engage in attacking anyone. They didn't raid United Nations posts or NGO projects. They simply marched around the interior, and they weren't really engaged by the International Stabilization Force, because that had been agreed to last year. A development I myself had totally supported, to pull the troops back and try and negotiate him back. But nevertheless, the situation at the moment, although it's still uneasy and a bit unsettled, is a lot better. My main concern is that the tensions in the past just might flow over into the political rival camps, and perhaps a little into the armed gangs, particularly political rivals, because we mustn't forget that problems in Timor weren't just, by any means, Reynado versus the rest. There are a lot of deeply rooted political differences about the outcome of the last election as far as Fretland's concerned. There also were acts of violence in Vakeki and other places which had nothing to do with Reynado. But generally speaking, I think the mood is to try and deal with these. And what has given it a boost is the United Nations Security Council agreement to continue the UNMET mission, which is very important at this stage. So I think that at the moment the feeling I'm getting is that there is a sense of optimism and hope.
Yeah. And very controversial, I think, was the decision of the East Timorese government to combine the police and the army to track down the remaining Reynado supporters. People were worried that the tensions between the two bodies might mean that this arrangement wouldn't work, and I think it also affected relationship with the Australian forces there. Would you say that's been reasonably successful, and is it likely to become a more permanent arrangement?
Yeah, I wouldn't entirely agree with that criticism, because I think what really needed to be done is to get more, getting the centre wants to have cooperation between these two arms dealing with security, the police and the defence force. But don't forget, there's no military role for the defence force at the moment. And it could be positive in the sense that as a joint party, they're telling the other side that now we are together, as it were. So I think it can work the other way. And I'm not sure it's a bad thing. I myself was a little worried about it, but might in the end be a good thing, because if you keep the defence force out or the police out, then that's perpetuating a difference which should never have existed, and indeed a rupture that really grew not because of dislike of each other, but because of some special circumstances in the past. The fact that the defence force had weapons, but unlike its predecessor, the Falun Til, didn't have a role. And there was a certain envy and rivalry that developed between it and the police. And I think the only way to get around this is to combine them. And my feeling at the time was to be training the Defence Force more as an emergency, a national emergency service, rather than just a Defence Force, because that's where its role must in most times be, rescuing. In cases of natural disasters or whatever.
And in the post, we could call it the post-Renato era, we're seeing some tensions emerging between, well, certainly the PD, the Democratic Party, and Fretilin, yet some other parties seem to be closer to Fretilin's position on certain issues. Can you see an increase or a lessening of political tensions now?
I think if anything they should lessen. Certainly some of the politicians and of the PD had some sympathy with Renato, or not necessarily with Renato's action in conducting a rebellion, as it were, but they were certainly keen on a project to bring him back into the community and perhaps see him tested as a political leader. Frankly, I wouldn't disagree with that. That's what I was planning to do when I'd proposed to go and meet with him last year. I'd met him before. And that was to suggest that he really give up the armed sort of rebellion and come back and try his hand at politics. That really tests his political leadership. And I think many people felt that one way of getting him out of the mountains, because after all, it was always intimidating. It was a fact of challenge to the government, and his statements, wild statements very often, in the mountains, didn't help governments struggling with the development of an economy which has been lagging for quite a while. So really, I think there's a good point in that. I don't think it should become too serious, but of course, it's the other tensions that are a bit more worrying between the Fretilin side and the coalition, particularly relating to the elections. Some still feel that it was not a just outcome, and I noticed here and there that the Mali Alkatiri is referred to by Fretilin as the de facto Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Well, of course.
Yeah. Well, he's not pushing that himself.
Probably is. No. No, I think Fretilin's got a very important role to play here. I mean, what Fretilin leaders mustn't forget is they've got a special responsibility, because they've got a long experience. They've got the experience of government, but they also have the long experience of conducting the quest for independence, going back a very long way, and that has always meant reaching across and encompassing not only the views of the left, and I think that's where José Ramos Horta, when he played a leadership role, played a very important role in bringing people together, and that's particularly during the times of when Timorese political parties were in the diaspora, and they had lots of rivalries that were making unity in the quest for independence difficult.
Yeah, and speaking of José Ramos Horta, he seems to be making a fairly speedy recovery, and we're all very pleased about that. I'm just wondering, I mean, we're just speculating here, Jim, but do you think the experience may have changed him, changed his mind about a few things? I mean, certainly his offer of, or his support for the impunity for an investigation into Indonesian war crimes was quite controversial. And would you care to speculate on whether he might be changing his position on anything? Or
I don't know this. I think it's a very important element in his politics. It's a very strong, commitment to conciliation and negotiation. Now, let me put things right about his support for him, for immunity. Horta didn't start that. That was started by Shanana, who wanted to forget the past. Horta, of course, has a lot of things that he can't forget. Four of his family were killed by Indonesian troops or Indonesian operations. But as he saw it, being the pragmatist, is that, which I understood, and that is that if the Timorese government were to press for a tribunal, what would happen is that they wouldn't get support in the Security Council, particularly at that time. Indonesia was a member of the Security Council. They wouldn't get support for it. But in doing so, they would so antagonize Indonesia that they might have quite serious difficulties, whereas the best thing to do would be to negotiate it. Negotiate with Indonesia. I wouldn't say that Horta's given up hope that there will be some kind of re-examination by Indonesia of what transpired during this period. I certainly haven't, and I hope it does happen, because more and more, as we read what's happening in Indonesia, more and more there's pressure to expose what happened in the past. And that's everything, of course. That's not what happened in 65, and it's what happened since then. It's the killings that have taken place in Indonesia, and of course what took place in East Timor. Eventually this will come out. Personally, I think there should be international pressure, and I'm sure at least some of the Indonesian Timorese leaders would support this, and many Indonesians would support it, because what is at stake is exposing to the Indonesian community itself the brutal culture of their military in these past years. And only by a full exposition of that brutality can reform, adequate reform, eventually take place.
And yeah, I've noticed that the British, or a group of British people, have taken on the task of getting some kind of international action on the death of the five newsmen, now known as the Balibo Five. I'm not sure what Horta's position was there, but do you think that could lead to anything? It seems as if the British parliamentarians may have an Interpol investigation into the Indonesians responsible, and they may be brought to justice that way.
Well, there's more to it than that, actually. It was actually raised in the British Parliament by a Labour Member of Parliament, and I understand there has been a decision by the British government to have a look at it. It's not just a matter of getting Interpol to investigate it. Already there is a legal process, one respected in terms of British law. It's a question of examining it and deciding whether a warrant which has been called for the arrest of two Indonesian military officers at the time, one of whom is now a retired Lieutenant General and a former Minister for Information. That could be a major step in that direction. I think Horta, you were asking me this question earlier, it's really important. I don't think he's changed in that way, and it's very interesting that one of his first statements when he came conscious, was to urge his people not to fight each other over this issue. Mm. I mean, it's his conciliation, which, in a sense, I sometimes think is more practical than that manifested by Shanana. Mm. I think he realizes that this is, that really something like this can be used to unite rather than divide a people. But as far as Balibo and Horta goes, that's very important to Horta, because he went to Balibo. He tried to persuade the Australian newsmen to withdraw, which, and they ignored him. They said they were happy, they'd be all right there. So he came back. And he was very worried and very upset about it, because he knew them. So I think he'd be happy to see this unravelled and to see those responsible brought to justice, or at least fully exposed. And in large measure, that was done in the Australian case in Sydney. But still, it needs to be done in Indonesia. That's the important thing, that these issues need to be brought out in Indonesia, because in the first instance, it's what their commanders did. It's what happened under their regime. And when we think of Saddam Hussein being executed and the execution being welcomed by some people, like some, like the United States, and even in Australia, you know, under President Suharto, who occupied the same role as Saddam Hussein, the head of the government, I mean, a million people died, most of them Indonesians, as well as many Timorese, and in military operations, obviously sanctioned by the president. And so why should he get clean away with it? Of course, he's died now. But still, I think it is time for this to be brought out so they can understand what the Orde Baru, the new order of Suharto, was really like. And also to understand the sort of full nature of crimes against humanity and the need for them to be punished. And the biggest need of all is that the punishment or the examination of crimes against humanity actually leads to reform of those responsible for those crimes, or the organizations in which the commanders existed, operated.
Yeah, well, I think given that one of those responsible is, I think he's currently the mayor of Jakarta, it doesn't look like an easily achieved result.
Well, he was there. He claims he wasn't there, and there's no doubt he was in Balibo. I know the general concern. That's a slightly different matter. He's been in Timor. But I think the thing is, most senior military officers in the TNI served in Timor. Some of them, and this includes even the president for a time, was commander of one of the most notorious battalions, 744 Battalion. What we really need to know is what happened during these periods. Were they responsible? Were they acting on orders from Jakarta? Or were they just doing what they thought was appropriate? Well, these are all questions that I think need to be answered, because we mustn't forget that there's a lot of talk about terrorism been going on for years now, since 9/11. But the most fearsome, the most dangerous form of terrorism is state terrorism.
Well, thanks very much, Jim. I think you've given us some very good insights into what can be achieved with an understanding of human rights. And thank you very much for talking to Community Radio, TuneIn FM and Latin Radical.
Thank you very much. Yes, that's a very important point, because, you know, it's the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration, and we must never forget it wasn't just a listing of some lots of rights that against governments. It's a universal code of conduct for us all. In the first instance, for those with power of oppression like governments, but really for us, a code of conduct for all citizens.
Thank you, Jim.